All right, we don't have an intro today because, you know what, this is getting to be a little bit of a pattern with the nose. Either we know exactly what we're going to do, or we have no idea what we're going to do. And to tell you the truth, some of the shows where we have no idea what we're going to do, like until the last minute, have been some of the best shows that we've done recently. So that augurs well today, let me just say, because it took us a long time to figure out what our topics would be. We've got them now. We certainly have a great nose panel. We have a Can't Lose panel. Jim Chapdelaine is with us, an Emmy Award-winning musician, producer, composer, recording engineer, and patient advocate for people with rare cancers. Irene Papoulis teaches writing at Trinity College. Kate Rushen is a poet and writer who teaches in the Amistad Freedom Trail Project. They're all regulars on the nose. They know what they're doing. So let me just tell you what we're going to – maybe I should tell them when the one we're not doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
We came very close to doing this thing about – well, first of all, there's a very interesting book coming out called Blitzed. It's written by a German writer. It's actually been translated into 18 languages now as a bestseller in Germany, basically sort of unveiling the fact that the Nazis used a lot of methamphetamine and other kinds of drugs like that, not only to fuel their resolve and keep them up late when they were invading France, but also just to sort of get them it is like National Socialism in pill form, basically. And then that kind of got us thinking also about how many stimulants – you know, whether it's Red Bull or Four Loko or Adderall or Ritalin or meth, you know, are being used in America now, and whether that has some connection to our political scene. But we, I don't know.
That show would have only been 30 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. We would have talked really fast and then ended the show. So we've parked that one. That we'll probably get back to that at some point. What we're going to do today, also something a little bit unusual. We're kind of going to build the first two segments. This feels very self-indulgent on my part. We're going to build the first two segments on conversations that I've been having, not always amicably, with people on social media. And so our topics today basically are sports defensible? Is religion defensible? And are cargo shorts defensible? The overarching title for the show, however, is Does God Wear Cargo Shorts? And by the way, spoiler, God does.
She does?
She absolutely does. She can rock those cargo shorts. So,
and Colin is wearing cargo shorts right now.
I went as dad core as I possibly could today.
And I wore my bow tie for Charles Osgood.
Yeah. Kate Rushen would never leave the house dressed the way I am right now. All right. So here we go. We're going to start out with, in fact, a conversation that we have a lot here on the show, like behind the scenes, because, for example, this week we actually did two different segments that had to do with sports figures. And one of the things that we discover is when we do them, people complain. Not everybody, but people complain. They sort of – like there was a guy on our Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page today saying, so can I go over to ESPN and WFAN and get a discussion of politics and other meaningful issues since you guys are talking about sports? We've gotten a lot of commentary of a similar type on Facebook. It also derives a little bit from a line in a column that I put out this week. We're not a smart nation. We like football, The Bachelorette, America's Got Talent. We finally have a political process that combines all three. And so people have been just talking about this. And one of the things that I discover – and Irene, I feel like not that you're a nullificationist about sports, but you would fall – my sense of you has always been that you fall into the category of someone who – is not that interested in sports. Sports is not part of your sort of way of understanding America.
That's true. And I am one of those people that says, why do they get 82? Because they said, you know, more people than watch the Super Bowl for the debate. Like, why is that the measure of the thing that the most people are going to watch, the Super Bowl? Mm-hmm. But I'm also thinking that in a way because there's so many Colin McEnroes in a way. There's the sports Colin McEnroe. And some people associate you with just politics, some people with other things. So it's like they want you to be their Colin McEnroe, which I think is kind of interesting.
Don't we all want him to be our Colin
yeah,
McEnroe?
Yeah, that's true. Everyone.
I don't think anybody wants me the way I'm dressed today. But anyway.
That's Skippy McEnroe.
Yeah, I'm Skippy McEnroe, yeah.
I always like the crossover sports things, like the emotion. Like when I watch sport, I happen to be near a television where somebody who's really into it is watching it. I think I'm always struck by the sort of emotional dramas that people get. It's an excuse for emotional, emotional drama in some way that I find interesting.
See, one of the questions that I have, Kate, is whether you can fully understand the culture you're in without having some kind of understanding about sports. It's kind of like at one point, Wolfie, when I first met her, had never watched The Godfather. And I said, well, you kind of have to – I mean, you just kind of like won't get a whole bunch of things if you don't watch The Godfather. You have to watch The Godfather. You know?
Really
and,
not an American unless you watch it.
You're not even in a position to have an interesting critique of other people who are Americans if you're not, if you haven't watched The Godfather. And it's kind of like, you know – I mean, not just like Muhammad Ali and stuff like that. Obviously, that goes without saying. But if you don't have some kind of bedrock relationship with sports or at least – I don't know. You can't – the people who have this force field up, I just sort of think they're in danger of not getting it.
Yeah. You know, I was not a great athlete in high school, but sports and poetry saved my life. So I have a real appreciation for the community that sports can give. And I like watching sports. I don't follow anything in particular, but all the big things, I'm into it. Super Bowl, Wimbledon – whatever the big thing is.
Could you say how sports saved your life?
Yeah, sports and poetry together.
Well, I was a shy kid, not quite fitting into any group. And one of my first friend groups was, the girls on the hockey team. And I knew the field hockey team. And, you know, when I was reading about entering this new high school, we didn't have sports at all in my school, in my little working-class African-American town. I'm reading the pamphlet for deciding what you want to do, what extracurriculars you want to get involved in. And I saw that they had hockey. They had girls' hockey. And I said, gee, that sounds interesting, but I don't know how to skate. I wonder if they'll teach me how to skate. So I went from there to, you know, having my first group of friends on the field hockey team and on the basketball team. And actually one of those people is living here in Connecticut now. We're reconnected after all these years.
In sports and poetry, as a poet, I mean, those are not disconnected elements, I think, in particular of Marianne Moore. Marianne Moore is like this huge baseball fan. She wrote poems about – she described the catcher Elston Howard as squatting like a frog or something. She had some great way of analogizing between his catcher's crouch.
If you could believe it, I collected baseball cards. Mm-hmm. I wish I had that Vita Blue today.
Mm. And, Jim, I feel also like – I have this quote that's sticking out in my head right now, which is it's from an essay by Roy Blunt Jr. where he's talking about his efforts to understand opera and go to opera and like opera. And he says various things that are very affirming of opera. But he says, on the other hand – and I can't remember which opera he's talking about. He said, I was sitting there and at a certain point I realized my attention had drifted away and I was mentally picturing an especially piquant single that I'd seen Maury Wills hit one time.
I sort of get that. I have the same thing with opera that maybe other people have with sports. Two things occurred to me while you guys were talking. One is that there is a clear line through sports and religion, right? Because anytime somebody wins a sporting event or does something incredible, the first person they thank is God usually, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they even kneel in the end zone. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an interesting sort of through line. The other thing is I have imagined up till now that sports is this huge behemoth that dominates our society. So I looked up who's making entertainment dollars. Mm-hmm. And here's where sports comes in. Alcohol is number one and followed by entertainment drugs. Which include cannabis, cocaine, and ecstasy, followed by prostitution, then restaurants, movies, gambling, pornography, and then sports. If you fold gambling in with sports, then it's right up there with pornography. So that's just in dollars generated in our economy.
But you don't have people saying like, you know, those people don't go to restaurants. What's wrong with them? Or maybe you do, actually.
Well, I just think – I mean, sports are omnipresent, right? So sure. I assume that they are the dominant entertainment form in the society, but they're really not.
Well, Irene and I were talking yesterday in a forum about Monday night's debate, and I was saying that, you know, I mean – and I think it was maybe even was part of your original question at the forum – is that, you know, we inevitably talk about who won the debate, right? Which is sort of a weird thing because it's people talking for 90 minutes, you know, and nobody's really scoring it. There are certain kinds of debates that are scored in certain ways.
And
but
he gassed in the second half,
right? Yeah.
So people do use those metaphors all the time.
But it's a weird thing when you think about it. Kathleen James Jameson from the Annenberg Institute says it's ridiculous. You shouldn't really talk about that. You can't win talking for 90 minutes or lose talking for 90 minutes. But we – because it's packaged and sold that way and because of who we are and probably because of sports, we really do have to think about that.
I think that's so interesting to think about politics that way and to think about, wow, is that why everybody wanted to watch the debate, to see who won? And to a large extent, yeah. But just one more thing about sports is after hearing Kate talk, I was thinking that the way we – I mean, we all have a relationship to sports because of what happened in high school or school, you know. And so and I think that probably has a lot to do with how we define our relationship to sports later, you know. Like, so I was the – you know, neurotic poet hiding in the library reading poetry who said, I don't want to, you know, go out on the field with those girls. You know, I just don't feel comfortable. And so I never got over that in a way.
Well, that's cool. We would have met anyway because I also.
The poetry connection.
Yeah, I was also in hiding out in the library
right.
as well.
So you have an interesting combination of those two. Yeah.
I just sort of, I guess I sometimes wonder, how would you convince somebody? Like, I got emails from or I guess Facebook comments and stuff like that from people who, you know, had pretty radical objections to sports. I've often one person wrote, I've often wondered what would happen if we turned all of our sports time, energy and profits to feeding the hungry or ending wars. Somebody else wrote, I see the national pastime obsession with sports viewing as a tremendous lost opportunity sink, not to mention pseudo-tribalism. I realize this is a minuscule minority position likely to make me a pariah at any given social gathering. Another comment was, who cares? We've got bigger problems right now. And it's sort of – it's like if you want to make the case for sports, it's kind of an interesting
– Well, if you're a monoculturalist and you are like a music freak, right, that tends to be exclusive of other things because your whole mindset is focused on every aspect of musical culture or whatever. And that could – there are sports guys who are so drilled deep that they walk around in cargo shorts and don't have a life. If you're just broadly interested in culture, sports sort of has to play some role, whether you like it or not. It's part of our culture.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of struggling with how to express this exactly, although I feel as though so much of my humanity is tied up in this in certain ways. I mean, I happen to be a Green Bay Packers fan. A lot of Sundays I get together with a bunch of other people. They're all from Wisconsin. They have that excuse. I really don't. But we all sit in this one couple's living room, and we talk, and we're too very focused on the show, and everybody knows that the phone won't ring because nobody would ever call a Green Bay Packers fan during the game. You know, but we also, I don't know. It's like it's a very tender kind of thing too. One couple's older. Each of them they're in their 80s, and they're each been struggling with serious health problems. And so we worry about that, and we talk about that, and it's all kind of wrapped up. It's a conversation with people that I just wouldn't have if it weren't for sports.
But, I mean, if it weren't for sports, you wouldn't have it? Because in a way, what you described could be, just any kind of gathering. But is it an excuse, or is there something about the actual game that really makes you bond with those people?
Well, we all share this tremendous passion. You know, I mean, like, it is, and it's men and women, and we couldn't be, I mean, everybody is completely obsessed with this.
Yeah, I've heard it said that if you want to lift yourself up, pick a team and root for it. Root for that team, and that it can help you rise above the struggles of your everyday life.
But isn't that – you could pick like an actor or a musician or, you know, any number of other people and do the same thing. Would it be different? Is
Although
there something about
sports? Although that takes a little longer. There's a longer arc there. You know,
and
also to Colin's point there,
the
sort of commonality thing, I think there were a lot of – old guys in New England, including my dad, who hung on to watch the Red Sox win the World Series in 2004, and he could die content after that, which he did.
That was really a life-changing event for him.
Well, I think also – we talked about this yesterday on the show. Sports is a really interesting prism through which to look at race. Understanding, say, race in Boston and understanding sports in Boston, these things go hand in hand. The role that Bill Russell played, the role that David Ortiz played. Even there's a lot of people, for example, who would never understand – that David Ortiz and Henley Ramirez do not identify as black, do not identify certainly don't identify as African Americans. They're Dominicans. But, you know, if you followed sports, you might get that in a way that you would, you know, there's a lot of people who just would never have any opportunity to think about such a thing.
Well, you know, I lived in Boston for a time, and I just couldn't hang with the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. I had to go Yankees.
Yeah.
And what was called the curse of – what was it? The curse of the Bambino.
Mm-hmm.
I always said in my mind that it was actually the curse of Jackie Robinson, mm-hmm. because they turned him down when they had a chance to get him.
And Willie Mays. They could have had a lineup that included Ted Williams, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Bobby Doerr, Johnny Besky. They could have had both of those guys. They turned them both down. Yeah.
But the Boston Celtics were the first to field an all-black starting five.
And the Boston Red Sox right now are the blackest team in baseball. The most African-American team in baseball. Anyway, all right. We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about something else that people object to talking about. That's the theme of today's show. It's sports, religion, and cargo pants.
That simple fact is plainly obvious to see. We're going to kick your collective posterior. Of course you realize we're speaking figuratively.
All right. This show is way too much about me and my issues. We really try to avoid that most of the time. But
no, we like you.
It's just
that's why people tune in.
Colin is doing this show while laying down on the couch.
Right, yeah. Exactly. No, you're this on is, fire today, Colin.
This is like a therapy session for
you're
me.
You're
on all right.
fire.
Mm-hmm. So as many people listen to the show know, I've been more active in religion. I've been going to church every Sunday if I'm in town in the last, well, I guess, maybe almost 18 months now than I ever have in my life, really. And so it kind of, you know, dribbles out here and there and things that I write or things that I say. And so one of the things that I've been encountering on social media is the way in which these days, you know, in stark contrast, I freely acknowledge, to 25, 30 years ago, where it was the exact opposite way. If you were an atheist, it's something you really, you know, had to hide from the world except under very safe circumstances, much harder back then. But these days, atheists feel very empowered. There's kind of the four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse, Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett. And so, when I mention anything about religion, atheists on social media, they feel very empowered to say things that strike me, quite frankly, as bigoted. They'll say religion is superstition and unicorns. They'll ask me if I disavow some terrible thing that was done in the name of religion. They say stuff sometimes that strikes me as kind of stupid. When they challenge me to say anything good that religion has ever done, which they actually will do, I'll say, well, I mean, faith really undergirded the Reverend Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement. One person told me, in all seriousness, on social media, that Martin Luther King, the Reverend Martin Luther King, was, quote, a pretty secular guy, unquote. And another told me that King was great despite the Bible, not because of the Bible. And so I now sort of call this Falwell atheism. They're just like Jerry Falwell, but they're on the other side. You know, they're every bit as intolerant. And I don't know. I'm just interested in hearing from other people's perspectives because I've become somewhat defensive about all this. I'm interested in the way the worm has turned. You know, as Tom Stoppard talking about this in one of his plays, one of his characters says, you know, when did the worm turn? At what point did the nose have it? Not the nose, but, you know, as opposed to the eyes have it, the nose have it. So I don't know, Irene. I mean, how does this all play out for you? I just sort of feel like, you know, obviously be respectful of everybody's stuff.
Well, right. I mean, I was raised Unitarian, and that's what we're all about, being respectful.
I like the idea that you were raised Unitarian.
You're like one of five.
And yeah. I still, yeah, Kumbaya is one of my favorite songs. You know, yeah. I think it's beautiful. I don't think people should trash that song because it's a great song, but it's ruined by the stereotype. But anyway, I also feel like really caught on both sides because in a way, those people that are anti, you know, the militant atheists, I think feel really strongly that our scientific view of the world, things mm-hmm. we can prove, are the most important, and it really upsets them because, for good reason, in my perspective, you know, there's a lot of incredible damage throughout history that's been done in the name of, you know, religion, fundamentalist religion, et cetera, in the name of sort of a, from their perspective, fantasy. So I feel like, you know, I can understand why they would just be so frustrated and upset at the thought of somebody else. But on the other hand, I can also see the other side. So I don't know the answer.
I mean, I've struggled with this a bunch of times recently. I was on this podcast, Unorthodox, which is a Jewish podcast, and Mark Oppenheimer, the host, who knows a little bit about what I've been up to, he really wanted me to talk about it, and I discovered I kind of froze up, and I got a little nervous. When we took questions from the audience later, this is kind of a national podcast, but they were taping it down in Woodbridge. I don't know. One guy sort of said, "Well, you know, I noticed that you kind of danced around that or something," and I just. I hate to think of myself as dancing around anything. Now, some of it was.
Thomas.
He was asking me to explain, yeah, or Peter more, actually. But he was asking me to explain this to a largely Jewish audience. And, I mean, I've become religious but not Jewish. I didn't know how that was going to go over. It's just sort of weird that your religion these days, Kate, if you have one, is something that, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's sort of strangely not – it's like cargo shorts. It's not cool sometimes.
Well, I was raised, as I said, in a working class African American town. So I was raised Methodist and African American, African Methodist Episcopal, and I belong to African Methodist Episcopal Zion now.
You need an easier to pronounce church. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just AME, AME Zion, but I also grew up. Around a lot of Jewish people and actually know a fair amount about Judaism and was actually drawn to aspects of Judaism. And then later in life, start learning about Buddhism. So I kind of bring all that to the table. But I still stick to the faith of my grandparents. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Europe at 16 and my grandfather told me that he prayed me back and forth across the ocean. I accept that. I believe that. I'm grateful for it.
Hmm. You know, Jim, first of all, if I'd known that we were going to do a show about things that are considered indefensible by other people, and then I'd known that Irene really likes Kumbaya, I totally would have added that to the list.
Yeah. Why, you hate it? Don't tell me you
hate
Kumbaya.
I don't hate Kumbaya. I don't judge.
Yeah, no, there's a couple of songs that could have made that list probably. Yeah. Pop Confections. You know, I was raised a Roman Catholic and strict Irish Roman Catholic, complete with guilt and shame and all the things that went with it. So you had a choice either to sort of remain in the flock or to eventually become an atheist, which I did, but I waited till my health was better before I did, and till I thought it was safe. And I think since then I've become much more flexible, and I'm really not an atheist anymore, because to me that's as militant as the most born again Christian conservative might be, like your Falwell reference. Mm-hmm. So I'm firmly agnostic, if that's possible. And I've kind of watched it. As you know, I've tagged along with you a few times because your inspiring pastor, Nancy, has made me faith curious. Mm-hmm. And as I try to I try to rub up against these people, and it hasn't – I can't get it on me yet. I tried, but I don't need to.
He doesn't literally rub up against the people at my church.
Well, they just – not that they notice.
That's fraudage. That's a whole different thing.
Wow, left turn of religion.
You know, Jim, you say you were raised Catholic. I was raised Methodist. Yesterday, I was feeling low. I needed to put my mind on positive thoughts. I actually went to noon mass yesterday.
Wow!
And it was I think it's a Polish or Ukrainian church, and it was helpful to me.
See, whenever I feel a little down, I just say the act of contrition in Latin, and I don't know anything that's in there. But I did memorize it in Latin.
But Irene, just to respond to something that Jim said, I feel like there's plenty of atheists who are tolerant atheists. You know, I mean, they don't believe it. They don't care whether I believe it. They don't care whether Kate went to mass yesterday. They don't care about any of this kind of stuff, and that's perfectly fine. I think that's really great. That's sort of how I feel about their atheism. I have no interest whatsoever, zero interest in trying to get somebody to stop being an atheist, none whatsoever. I'm not good enough at what I'm doing right now to insist that anybody else try to do it. But I don't think I would ever feel that way.
Is there a component of being a Christian you think that demands that you proselytize?
Not to me, no. I mean, obviously there is a component of being a Christian that people interpret that way. It's in the New Testament. It's not something somebody made up. But But no, I mean, I would never, if somebody's very chill with their atheism, that's fine with me. I just have not been prepared for is the number of people who feel comfortable kind of crapping on it, you know, like saying it's superstition and unicorns. Those words have been used to me, and I'm thinking, really? That's what you got out of atheism? You know, is that you could really sort of be contemptuous of other people?
Because. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm more of the I don't know where exactly I fit in myself, but I feel much more sympathy with those people than you do because of their frustration that anyone could possibly not believe in scientific fact, you know, that there's anything beyond scientific fact. We have no proof, at least most of us believe, that we don't have any proof of anything beyond what we can measure by our five senses. Mm-hmm. And so they feel incredibly frustrated and betrayed by somebody that tries to, especially someone like you that they think is, you know, smart, thoughtful person who is going to take a step beyond the things that we can prove scientifically.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I think about this a lot. I think it was very easy for us. We knew that the Garden of Eden was church and the theory of evolution was school. Mm-hmm. And we didn't seem to have a big conflict about it.
But there's a lot
so
of people
I don't understand
who would,
it.
Who would argue with that, I think, right?
Yeah. Yes. So, yes. I just don't understand it because in my little town, people didn't seem to have that kind of conflict and that evolution wasn't a belief. You don't believe in evolution. You believe in God.
I mean, I think that notion of keeping stuff separate is an important one. There's a page one story today about evangelicals who feel very abandoned by the political process and abandoned by – yeah. So – and I don't have any real sympathy for them, even though I attend what is nominally an evangelical Baptist church, but not their kind. but I mean,
but isn't that a judgment right there?
What?
So we're all at some point. There's all degrees of judgment
right
here,
and,
well,
we're
yeah.
And when you and I'm, I know I'm cutting you off, but I'll forget because I'm old. You referenced the sort of four horsemen.
Yeah.
And I just want to get back to that for 1 second, and then I'm going to pass the ball to you deep. I think. Because you referenced that atheism was sort of in the closet or was a fearful position to take, those guys militated it and were able to drag people out. And by necessity, they would be the Falwells, right? The the hard corner.
I think that's a great point.
So they're necessary for other atheists to feel they can come out into the sunshine and speak their mind. Now, I would think that there's going to be a relaxation of some of their militarization of this.
I think that's a great, great point. Now, the point that I was going to make is, you know, there is – the reason that I'm not sympathetic to the people who are described in the New York Times today, and these very specifically are the people who own little sort of – wedding facilities who won't let gay people use them and, you know, won't make cakes or pizza or whatever for gay people and feel as though that's their religious conviction and their religious freedom is not being upheld and they don't see Trump or Clinton as particularly eager to do that is, you know, here's the thing. This country is set up a certain way. You can believe anything you want and you can worship any way you want in church or whatever whatever religious configuration you set yourself up in. You can't run a pizza parlor that way. You know, I mean, you can't run a health clinic that way. You can't run a lunch counter that way. You can't do anything like that because all of those things are subject to, say, our civil rights laws. I mean, you can have a religion that says that black people are inferior and no one can stop you from having that religion, from meeting every Sunday or whatever wherever you meet. You can sit there and just say that all day and no one will ever do anything to you because you have that freedom. You can't run a lunch counter according to that religion and not serve black people because that's against the law.
It's against the law, but because you respect the law. I mean, so people, the fundamentalist position is there's something very wrong with the law if it doesn't allow my religion, you know? And so they're, you know, there's these parallel militancies on either end of the spectrum.
Right. But I mean, but it's still, you know, it's sort of back to Kate's dichotomy, you know, that the just understanding when you're in church and when you're not in church. So your church may have all kinds of unusual things to say about health practices, But you can't bake wedding cakes that way if you're violating the health
code.
And that's not part of your religious freedom to do it. In other words, the Constitution doesn't guarantee you the right to bake cakes or run an urgent care clinic or run a restaurant or a shoe store or anything according to your religious principles. The only thing the Constitution guarantees you is the free exercise of your religion, which you don't do while you're running your shoe store.
And I believe freedom from religion is part of that too, right? Mm. So that so that a religion, we can't become a theocracy. It's one of the great things about the Constitution. We're one of the first societies that is not doesn't have a king or queen or a theocracy,
except Connecticut.
Well,
we're the last state to get rid of a state religion. We had a state religion long after the Constitution was ratified.
That was Tuesday this week.
No, it's 1814, something like that. So the country had been around a long time. Connecticut still had an official state religion that was first among all.
And maybe those strains still exist in Connecticut.
There was like a bow hunting season against Unitarians. It was terrible. You would not have thrived in this situation.
I grew up about 10 miles from the great radio religious radio broadcaster Carl McIntyre, and he was talking about God and his beliefs. He broke away from the Presbyterian Church. And we all knew that when Reverend Dr. Carl McIntyre talked about Christians, we knew in my little town of Lawnside, New Jersey, we knew he was not inviting us to his church. And I knew he wasn't talking about me or my family or my town. So I think I kind of grew up not expecting all religious people to be accepting of me, even if we were supposed to be part of the same religion.
Yeah, well, that's – yeah.
We've got a bunch of calls coming in here. We've got at least one of them before we move on to the very important topic of cargo shorts. Here's Ainsley from Brantford. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Colin. Thanks. Thanks for including my call.
Sure.
Full disclosure, I'm a raised Episcopal, non-practicing, or Episcopal as we call it, Catholic light.
Yeah.
I think an example
so do Catholics.
I think an example of a lot of people's relationship to religion, for people who know Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, the episode where it was the Jewish holidays, by the way, are coming up, I think, next week. And Larry David seems like an archetypal atheist, but it was really important for him to get tickets to the synagogue to go to the service. So, something about the need for the community, connection with whatever is higher, the sublime. So even though Larry seems like someone who would have no need for religion, in that case, he really did.
Thanks for that point. I'm going to actually wrap up the discussion, this part, with something from Andrew Sullivan's much discussed I Used to Be a Human Being cover story in the New York Magazine. It's the September 19th issue. But he talks about spirituality in this context. The essay, which we're going to spend some time on at some future date, is all about basically what the internet has done to him, and he's not happy about it. So Sullivan writes, in his survey of the modern West, of how the modern West lost widespread religious practice, a secular age, the philosopher Charles Taylor used a term to describe the way we think of our societies. He called it a social imaginary, a set of interlocking beliefs and practices that can undermine or subtly marginalize other sets of belief. We didn't go from faith to secularism in one fell swoop, he argues. Certain ideas and practices made others not so much false as less vibrant or relevant. And so modernity slowly weakened spiritually by design and accident in favor of commerce. It downplayed silence and mere being in favor of noise and constant action. The reason we live in a culture increasingly without faith is not because science has somehow disproved the unprovable, but because the white noise of secularism has removed the very stillness in which it might endure or be reborn. And to Ainsley's point, I mean, one reason I go to church is not because I'm necessarily the greatest, most faithful Christian in the world, but I just need that little time to stop, and think a different way and stuff like that. And I do feel, as we're swept up in our internet, our digital life, we kind of don't get that. I mean, that's why Kate was at Mass the other day, I think. You just kind of need that moment, that little caesura, just to
do something else, think about something else.
And even atheists need that.
Yeah, but good. I think
touché.
There's. Yeah, no, I think there should be a nice place for some of these atheists I'm hearing from could just sit still and be quiet and, you know, just think about
the woods.
And they probably say sure.
Yeah,
you know, they probably say sure.
And just like a little place where they can think about relativity and quantum physics
exactly.
and stuff like that. You know, it's good. I like to think about those things too. All right, we would be remiss if we did not. Somebody else is going to have to lead this discussion.
Oh boy,
I think. Oh, no, okay, I'll do it. But.
Well, you seem very pro. I don't know if people need a visual. But
cargo pants, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody – would you like to try to describe how I am dressed right now?
Colin is wearing – let's start with the top. He's wearing a baseball cap that has
– just the letter C on it.
A C on it.
For
black
Chapdelaine.
With a red C.
Yeah.
Then he's got on a black shirt.
Tucked in.
Tucked in
to
with
my
a collar.
Oxford.
Tucked in. But the main event is the cargo khaki cargo shorts that he has that are sort of rumpled as khaki shorts are. But so that's not the main event. The main event is he's wearing a belt and then he has a little cell phone, a black cell phone shaped. Is there a name for it? Like sort
cell
of purse
case.
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 Thank you. Cell phone case that he has woven into the straps of his shorts so that he can keep his cell phone there. I don't understand why the phone isn't in the pocket of
it's
the cell phone.
It's a norm core
then
accessory.
Then he's wearing like white athletic socks and white sneakers.
All right. So we get this article. It's called What Fashion Anthropologists Think About the Relentless Cargo Shorts Boom. So we had a lot to absorb even in that title. I don't think any of us knew that we're fashion anthropologists. During the dearly departed summer of 2016, cargo shorts accounted for 15% of new short styles on online retailers, Kim Bassin noted at Bloomberg, up from 11% last summer. Target, the hip, wholesome retailer whose name you may pronounce with a whimsically soft G as in Target, accounted for 43% of the new cargo short styles. And why not? Retailers sell over $700 million worth of side-pocketed short pants a year, Bassin reports. $700 million on cargo shorts. What a time to be alive. The cargo short, well, and then the anthropologists go on to say that pockets themselves have historically been coded masculine, as an anthropologist would say, and it took a certain century of effort for them to become normalized in women's apparel. You not only won the right to vote, you won the right to have cargo shorts if you want to have them. So, but there is, Jim, there's a way in which if you're wearing cargo shorts, you've kind of given up something.
They are.
Like I look.
Sartre would say.
I look really bad.
Cargo shorts are the death of hope. So,
but why? Why
well,
are they?
I don't know.
Unpack
you know,
that for
I looked into it. So they their first appearance was 1938 in British military wear. So I get those are probably cargo pants because yeah. I don't think they had casual military wear then.
Well, when one took over a very hot place.
Right, right.
One might want cargo shorts.
Exactly. And probably help with actual cargo, I suppose. But really what the last 20 years they've become omnipresent and all of us have worn them. I mean, I don't know about you guys.
Yeah.
Irene and Kate, yeah?
Right. I've worn cargo
You've
pants.
Worn cargo?
You go
I have shorts.
So, I have so yeah. a hard time picturing. I mean, Kate Russian, who's like rocking always like this really cool straw hats and stuff like that. I
bow
mean,
tie today.
Bow tie, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually have a hard time picturing either
fire.
One of you. And,
yeah.
you, and you've yeah. worn cargo shorts?
No, I have
no.
to say not. Yeah. But I
you,
think
– because that's because you never did like the suburban – I mean, you know, you're a mom, but I just you don't really do mom core really, I don't think.
No, I try my best not to. I mean, in a way, I don't wear them for the same reason Hillary Clinton doesn't, you know? Like it just – it just wouldn't enhance the right places. But
I will say that my significant other, the Khaleesi, when I left today, said, "You can't go anywhere else dressed like that. You have to come home immediately after work." And then she said, "You know what's sad is you actually you would dress that way every day if you could. You know, you like dressing that way."
Is that true?
Well,
you know, my mom would say, "Colin, you better not get in an accident on the way home."
The older I get, I think I better not have an accident on the way home. But
right.
And well, so what did it? What did she? What was she objecting to? So she felt like the look that you had was somehow unacceptable.
And what does it suggest? What do cargo shorts
yeah.
suggest
okay.
to everybody?
Because
everybody
trying
has a different take.
I'm trying to figure that out. So, well, I think we can sort of go back. And the piece that we read also talked about the fact that, I mean, in some ways, things that aren't cargo shorts, you could argue, are symbolic of the oppression of women in the sense that if you don't have a lot of pockets and stuff like that and you're wearing like juicy couture or something like that, you know, everything about you is very visible, you know, and there's nowhere to hide and that kind of stuff. Whereas cargo pants are kind of baggy and, you know, cargo shorts. And so, but yeah, I think there's kind of, there's a suggestion in the cargo shorts that you carry, you're more concerned with like putting stuff in your pockets than you are with how you look, right? You just have, you don't care.
But why?
I wish we could do an audio equivalent of Kate Russian's eyebrows.
It's just another manifestation of cool, I think.
Yeah.
Cargo pants. It's, and you know, you have to be privileged enough to be able to wear them and not be punished for wearing them.
I don't agree with that at all, but I think it's like a great – I'm so glad you said it.
So,
anyway.
If they're cool
– But you might be right too.
If they're cool, doesn't cool ping and pong off cyclically? And
yeah,
so
but,
like maybe a couple of years ago, Colin's outfit – would be better if he had his baseball cap backwards. But he has resisted that. In fact, he is taking claim of the forward baseball cap, which we don't see enough of, I'd say.
A 60-year-old white guy with a backwards baseball cap, that's just probably never going to work.
Go to Fenway Park.
Where's your ponytail?
And there's a race component of this, although because like I always love the moment – I think it's the first Men in Black movie where basically Will Smith gets dressed exactly the way Tommy Lee Jones is, and he goes, "But I make this thing look good." You know, it's not exactly the word he uses, I think. But there's like certain ways in which like this. I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time picturing any of the African American people I know dressing like this. But I think if they did, they'd pull it off better. They just wouldn't look like dumpy and stupid the way I do right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could say that with any outfit. But I think the idea that if something is comfortable, it's somehow suspect. You know, like if you're like comfortable,
that.
You're
like
just kind of like
sweatpants.
You don't care, right? Sweatpants.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but you shouldn't leave the house in sweatpants. I'm sorry.
Really?
Have you ever been to the mall and see these pizza stained dudes walking around oblivious to everything?
That's the problem. Once you start wearing sweatpants, then you'll go out with the pizza stains on them.
Yeah, well, like that has something to do with the decline of Western civilization.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the problem with cargo shorts. They're just another step towards pizza-stained sweatpants.
There is no problem with cargo shorts. All right, we have to take a break. We're going to come back with endorsements.
I got a lot of stuff. I don't know where to put it. What am I going to do? How about some cargo shorts?
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Rebecca Black. You can hear all our shows on WNPR.org/Colin or subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. On Monday, The Scramble looks at the news from over the weekend. And now, back to Colin.
Should be Jonathan McCargo Pants, actually. All right, so it's time to endorse various things. I have to have a long time for my endorsement because it ties into what we've just been talking about, but I'll still go last.
Okay, good.
I don't really need a long
are you
time. That sounded imperialist.
Yeah. I don't have – I'm not endorsing much lately, but I do want to endorse investigative journalists like David Fahrenholt in the Washington Post writing about Trump's charities and Kurt –
I have to do a quick timeout. I'm on a mission right now to get people to say his name right. It's David Fahrenthold.
Fahrenthold.
I had to tell none other than David Plotz, who's the former editor-in-chief of Slate.
It's David Plotz.
Plotz, yeah. Plotz.
And the other one, Kurt Eichenwald of Newsweek, on how Trump's company violated the U.S. embargo to Cuba. And just, you know, there are still people. We always say, oh, what's wrong with the media? But there are still people out there doing that kind of work. And so I just want to endorse them.
Fahrenthold is like the Carly Rae Jepsen of journalism right now. He's going to win the Pulitzer. Everybody knows he's going to win the Pulitzer. He's going to win the Pulitzer for investigative journalism. It's like we already know that. And it's, you know.
I wonder if it's because he got
kicked off of Trump's plane. Was it just the Washington Post decided to go nuclear?
Well, you know, they have done some pretty interesting
work.
Yeah,
no, they've been really leading the charge.
But Fahrenthold really has done this remarkable bunch of reporting.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, mine is not nearly as high-minded. I would urge people, I don't know if it's still in theaters. I sure hope it is, but there's a movie called Hell or High Water. To me, by far, the best movie of the year that I've seen so far, with Jeff Bridges, Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and Gil Birmingham. There are women in it, but this is a man's story, I think, primarily. Set in Texas, modern day, but it's a Western, and it's amazing. The acting is great. The cinematography is great. The dialogue is great. And the plot is not what you think the plot is. So it's great. And if you can't see that, you could go see The Magnificent Seven, which would give you everything that you would expect from a Western, but not the – it's not at the level of Hell or High Water. But it's satisfying.
Thumbs up for A Magnificent Seven.
No, yeah, it was fun. It was really fun.
So Hell or High Water fails the Alison Bechdel test, right? Women have to be in it and not as
– There are women
the love objects of men.
Yeah, and they're not the love objects of men. But it's about these two brothers on a bank robbing spree.
Westerns are another genre that people put down, I think, and unnecessarily.
I like them. All right. And they're kind of back with these two movies, I hope.
All right, then. Kate Rushen, what have you got for us?
All right. Connected to sports, the one time I got to meet the great Venus Williams was at the Brooklyn Book Fair, and she was signing her book, Come to Win, in which she interviews 46 world leaders about the place of sports in their lives, including people like Bill Clinton and Condoleezza Rice.
Who can dunk?
Also, after all these years of listening to Faith Middleton talk about the Thimble Islands, I finally figured out where Stony Creek was and discovered the Thimble Island cruises and the Thimble Island taxis. And I found out that the outer island is actually a reserve, and we can go and visit for very reasonably priced little boat ride.
You stood a chance of seeing Jane Pauley out there in the Thimble Islands, who we almost talked about today too, because she's taking over CBS Sunday Morning. But she and Gary, I don't know if they're still out there. They used to be out there. All right. So, by the way, bulletin. You can go see Hell or High Water with or without Jim Chapdelaine, with or without Alison Bechdel accompanying you at the AMC theaters in Plainville today, a half an hour from the time the show ends, or at 8 o'clock tonight, with the Regal Branford Stadium 12. You have three show times there. So Hell or High Water still in theaters. I'm going to endorse – this is not a great TV show, but I know I'm going to be addicted to it. I've seen two episodes of it already. It's called Designated Survivor. The entire premise of it is that this is not a very happy premise, obviously, but you know, there's always somebody who doesn't go to the State of the Union address, a cabinet member. That person is sequestered so that if anything were to happen, like you know, a bomb blowing up the whole Capitol or something, there'd still be somebody left to run the government. Well, that's exactly what happens. The guy who's being sequestered is a kind of a liberal Democrat guy who owns, I guarantee you, three or four pairs of cargo shorts. His name is Tom Kirkman. He actually, at the time that he becomes president of the United States, is wearing a kind of a zip-up hoodie from Cornell. I think he's got a baseball hat on and maybe – or like when he finds out. And the worst pair of glasses ever. Like from the Lions Club, he would not take these glasses. It's surprising how many conversations about fashion go on at the time when the entire government is wiped out. Everybody else is dead. But there's a lot of conversations about like, you know, where is he going to get a suit? His wife is Natasha McElhone and she doesn't like having to wear a jacket that goes over the Kevlar. And I mean there's just like a lot of that kind of stuff.
You're going to wear that?
It really does tap into a lot of modern anxieties, though, about, you know, I mean, who's going to be president and how is that person going to legitimize him or herself in the office? And are we all going to be able to get along? Are we all going to be able to respect one another? In this case, of course, he has to, in addition to everything else, he needs a whole new cabinet. There isn't anybody left in the cabinet. All the things that we're talking about and worrying about right now are played out in the relatively safe environment of a one-hour primetime drama featuring Kiefer Sutherland. I guess I buried the lead. It's Kiefer Sutherland. They have to kind of de-Bowerize him. It's one of the reasons he has to look so nerdy, I think. So nobody thinks that he's going to whip out a gun and like run around and shoot all the people who did the bad thing. But anyway, I don't know. I'm completely hooked on it. But it could be just because I'm so worried about everything right now that I just need this place to sort of play it all out safely. All right. I was also asked to mention that Katie Dularski, our senior producer, is judging the Noah Webster House Real Ale Fest on Saturday night, 2:30, with Ryan Hanrahan, who actually knows more about beer than Katie, apparently, and even knows what kind of weather systems occur inside beer.
possibly. So anyway, that's something you could go do. And I think they're making up some kind of special beer. Or beer's gotten so complicated. I want to thank – I hope this was good. I hope everybody liked this because it was a little bit different than what we usually do here. So let us know. You can email me, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org, or go on the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. And I want to thank Irene Papoulis, Jim Chapdelaine, and Kate Rushen. I had a great time talking to you guys. We'll be back on Monday with The Scramble.
Talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh, yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington. Yeah.